Okay. The notion that revolutions always end in dictatorships is, I think, one of the most stubborn arguments raised in opposition to revolutionary Marxism. Even where people might agree with us that capitalism is a horrible system, maybe even that we need to get rid of it, a final reservation can often be expressed as power corrupts, people are too greedy, or that when a power vacuum exists in the process of revolution, it's filled by a new ruling class that's just as brutal as its predecessor. The argument presented in this talk rejects these criticisms. I'll hopefully convince you that workers' revolution is a means to liberation and that dictatorships are rather a feature of capitalism, used to impose class rule and strengthen the profit system. So I wanted to start with this really scientific diagram that Paul's going to hold for me, that you might have seen if, like me, you studied politics at school or university. So we can see on one side Stalin, this is the left wing, and on the other side Hitler, the right wing. And it pretty much illustrates that if you go too far with left-wing politics, with ordinary people trying to run the show, you end up with the worst kind of system, you end up with a dictatorship. And diagrams like this and the ideas that they embody position liberal democratic capitalism as the kind of best system that you could hope for, the extreme end away from dictatorship. It's an argument that's necessarily built on a distorted picture of Marxism that has little to do with the principles and aims of real revolutionary socialism. And I want to clarify now that revolutionary socialists don't simply think that Stalinism went too far or was too extreme, but actually that Stalinism is the antithesis of Marxism. It has nothing to do at all with what we stand for. Socialism, far from being about one great leader towering over and above society, is actually about radical, direct democracy based in our workplaces and universities, where ordinary people collectively and cooperatively determine how society is to be run. Socialism from below. This is the tradition that we stand in here in Socialist Alternative, and it's one that's completely different to the Stalinist systems that chose to misappropriate the language of Marxism. The first thing I want to deal with is the question of why we need revolution. Because the argument that revolutions always end in dictatorships implies that winning reforms within the system is a better way to change society, that the extreme act of revolution can be avoided. So if we only temper ourselves and maintain moderation, both in what we demand and the tactics that we use in achieving those demands, we'll avoid the sort of oppression that became the hallmark of life in places like Russia, China, Cuba, and the rest. But as socialists who reject Stalinism and one-party dictatorships, we aim to do more than simply change those at the top of society, which is what the argument for moderation is really about. Because whether politicians speak the language of free market capitalism, social democratic capitalism, or state-run capitalism, the lives of ordinary people in those societies is still filled with the suffering that's an inherent part of profit-driven systems. Elections don't alter, for instance, the dictatorship of the workplace, the control that a boss has over their workers. This remains untouched. A tiny few continue to control the vast majority of wealth in society. In this system, working class people will continue to be exploited and oppressed, regardless of what the politicians of the day may be saying. Instead, revolutionary socialists want to change entirely how things are produced and controlled in society, the whole process of how decisions are made and in whose interests they're made. And this is a change that doesn't come through the softly approach that reformists propose. The great Polish revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg put it this way. She wrote, "Whoever opts for the path of legal reform in place of or in contradistinction to the conquest of political power actually chooses not a calmer and slower road to the same aim, but a different aim altogether." Our program for change is not about a more ethical capitalism, a nicer form of exploitative class society. We want a completely different society, a classless one that's based on human need, real democracy, freedom, cooperation, and equality. And I think that if you genuinely commit yourself to this idea, you have to concede that it's simply not a goal that can be reached through capitalism and its own established mechanisms of control. Moreover, the notion that somehow by working within capitalism we can avoid dictatorships is utterly mistaken. The capitalist class relies on dictatorships and imposes them as a form of political control wherever it's necessary to do so. While it's important not to understate the democratic gains that have been won in countries like Australia, it's hardly the case that the Rudd, Brown and Obama governments have an unwavering commitment to democratic rights. They either cheer on or carry out the mass murder of Palestinians, Afghanis and Iraqis and do their utmost to ensure the stability of places like of regimes in places like Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Of course, so that oil can continue to flow and capitalist trade to flourish. And it's not just in developing nations or the Middle East where repressive state machines have been used to restore or maintain class control. Germany, Italy, Greece, Portugal and Spain, I've probably missed a few, but this is what I could think of, have all been subjected to fascism in response to working class movements that had undermined the stability of capitalism. Parliamentary democracy is an entirely dispensable element of capitalism, and we should have no illusions about it being otherwise. So if it's the case then that capitalism resorts to dictatorships whenever it needs to, how can we say that socialism, a system controlled by the working class, would be any different? There are some hugely significant differences that have to do with the material interests of those who earn a wage for a living. Firstly, the working class produces the profits of capitalism, yet it doesn't control them. With its labour, it supports the middle and ruling classes. It has an interest, therefore, in getting rid of exploitation and oppression, and as a corollary of that, an interest in radical working class democracy. But secondly, the class is organised in such a way that it relies upon democratic decision-making to exert its power. Workers must necessarily cooperate and act collectively if they're to use their industrial might in any effective way. And this means that a tendency towards democratic organisation exists within the working class. This is evident in the two historical examples that I want to flesh out here. And in fact, the first that I'm going to briefly draw on, the 1917 workers' revolution in Russia, is perhaps the best example of the amazing democracy that working class revolution can bring into existence. Yet this is in stark contrast to its prominent use in the criticism that socialism was tried in practice and failed. Anyone who has a desire to keep capitalism churning on will tell you that Lenin led directly to Stalin and that this proves that all power corrupts. Workers' revolution is destined to lead to gulags, show trials and mass starvation. Indeed, this is the interpretation supported by universities and mainstream teaching. It's utterly unconvincing, though, because it ignores the great achievements that were made in the first few months and years of that revolution. It can't explain, for instance, how abortion on demand, divorce rights, communal kitchens and childcare could be established to challenge sexism, how gay rights could be won 50 years before the gay liberation movement, how land could be redistributed, national liberation granted for autonomous regions, imperialist war brought to a standstill, and the oppression of Tsarism defeated, all under the direction of the mass of workers of that country through a system of workers' councils. Russia is proof of how revolutions don't always end in dictatorships. When they win, people can begin to create the kind of system where they can fulfil their real potential. So I don't want to revisit the events of the Russian Revolution much more because there's another session in the Foundation stream that deals with that. But I do want to emphasise the reasons behind how the gains made by the revolution could be lost to the authoritarian state capitalism of Stalin. Understanding this is very much about getting a real sense of the context that the Soviet government found itself in 1921. This was the year that the Civil War finally ended. Russia had been invaded by 14 imperialist nations determined not to let workers defeat capitalism. And although they didn't succeed, the effects of this war were absolutely devastating. The revolution had failed to spread, a factor necessary for its survival, and was increasingly isolated. The economy was in a state of near dissolution. The national income was a third of what it had been 8 years earlier. An industry where the working class was centred produced one-fifth of what it had produced before the Civil War. Coal mines, in particular, produced one-tenth of what they had previously, and iron foundries, one-fortieth. Railways were destroyed, the stocks and reserves that an economy depends on were exhausted. The resources used in fighting the war had bled the cities dry, not just of infrastructure and goods, but of the workers who made the revolution themselves, many of whom had given their lives defending it. So working-class cities like Petrograd, for instance, had only a third of their former population. Many had left the towns in search of food, and those that remained in the cities and employed, if they were lucky enough to be, were paid in wages that had become worthless because of the depreciation of the ruble. Isaac Deutscher, a biographer of Trotsky, vividly describes the situation. The old self-reliant and class-conscious labour movement, with its many institutions and organisations, trade unions, cooperatives and educational clubs, which used to resound with loud, passionate debate and seethe with political activity, that movement was now an empty shell. The abundance of goods and mass industry that socialism depends upon were destroyed, and the isolation of the revolution only added to this. It was at this point where the working class ceased to exert any meaningful power or control over the Soviet leadership that the socialist rule began to end. So did Lenin lead to Stalin because all power corrupts? Well, the suggestion that socialism failed in Russia because of greed or because the working class were corrupted by power is wrong and an insult to the hundreds of thousands who gave their lives to the victory of the revolution. The defeat of socialism in Russia must be attributed to the destruction of its material foundations and the particular historical circumstances that surrounded it. Another related criticism is that Stalinist Russia could have been avoided had the Bolsheviks been less extreme and compromised with those who wanted to kick the Tsar out but have some kind of liberal democratic capitalism. Given that we don't know what might have happened in Russia, I wanted to test this against the events that took place in Chile in 1972, one of the many examples where a movement did take up the strategy of reform rather than revolution. In my view, it's the best illustration of how mistaken the idea is that a more moderate road to socialism is a more peaceful one. So I want to turn to that now. In 1972 and 1973, the working class of Chile stood up against the injustice and oppression that ruled their lives in a movement that shook the foundations of Chilean capitalism. They demanded from a government that had been brought to power on many of these promises, extensive social reforms, the nationalisation of major industries, and land reform to end the suffering caused by a stagnant economy. But while workers were increasingly ready to fight for these changes, they demanded them always of the government, rather than seeking to get rid of the state altogether and rely on their own organisation and power. The man who led this government was Salvador Allende, a member of the Socialist Party of Chile, in coalition with the more left-wing Chilean Communist Party, amongst others. And these were parties that considered themselves anti-capitalist. They had deep roots in the working class, and they spoke openly of the need to end capitalism. You know, nothing like the Rudd Labor government or anything of the sort. Yet because of their place in government and their commitment to a peaceful and moderate road to that social change, they were simply unable to deliver what they'd promised and were increasingly compromised by their determination to maintain the authority of the state. Nevertheless, their left-wing credibility meant that the Chilean working class, even when its own actions consisted of breaking the law, continued right to the end to look towards Parliament to enact the changes that they sought. And this strategy of avoiding revolution later proved to be the decisive factor in the movement's crushing defeat. So the struggle began to culminate at the time when the ruling class, who were furious at the government and the nationalisations that had been taking place, imposed more and more lockouts and food shortages in an effort to force Allende out. The working class was increasingly combative in its response to this, using strikes, occupations and protests to defend its interests. By October 1972, they began to display an incredible strength. New groups of workers, previously unorganised, were drawn into the heart of the struggle. It gave rise to the Cordones, which were workplace-based decision-making bodies on which independent political organisation and indeed a new society could be built. Yet, they lacked the appropriate leadership for this to be widely contemplated, let alone take place. Despite that, workers' struggle in this period was absolutely pointing towards the new possibilities for direct democracy. And I think it gives weight to the argument about the tendency for mass workers' movements to organise in a radically democratic fashion. The Cordones are a prime example of that, but there were also daily occurrences of ordinary people randomly coming together and taking power into their own hands. And this is what happened at the beginning of 1973, when things really started to heat up in response to the bosses imposing a new food shortage, so shutting supermarkets, just stopping the production of food and so forth. There was a whole wave of resistance to this. In the shanty town of La Hermida, for example, 300 families marched on the local supermarket, demanding that it reopen. Several hours later, they'd opened it themselves and were busy calmly and efficiently distributing goods according to need. It was typical of many events like it across the country. The Cordones showed amazing initiative too, responding with fury to concessions made by the government to hand back some of the occupied factories. The Vicuña Mackenna Cordon began publishing a newspaper for the Cordones called Tarea Urgente. And I want to quote from this because it gives a real sense of the potential that existed had the workers' struggle gone further. And they wrote in their paper, "To the workers of this cordon call upon the working class to organise to defend the social property," meaning the nationalised part of the economy, "and the factories that were taken over during the bosses' strike. The law that proposes to hand them back does not reflect the feelings of the majority of workers who are ready to carry the struggle to defend their rights to its ultimate consequences." And they refused to acquiesce to the government's plan. At the end of 1973, Allende began to be squeezed from both sides. He announced going ahead with more nationalisations to appease workers, but at the same time attacked the revolutionary left for provoking the bourgeoisie. But neither the bosses nor the workers by now had illusions that change would be determined solely through Parliament. It began to be the case that either the ruling class or the workers would have to take power themselves. Yet the left's reliance on Parliament left it defenceless and impotent in the face of the mobilisation of the ruling class. Where a workers' revolution could have defended its struggle against the capitalists, the strategy of support for Parliament couldn't. The parliamentary road to socialism relies on the ruling class respecting democracy and the will of the majority. It relies on a fantasy. In reality, what happened? The capitalists' response in Chile makes the central purpose of dictatorship crystal clear: to crush working class organisation. On the 11th of September 1973, Augusto Pinochet led a military coup to bring down Allende's government and return business as usual. Within hours, known leftists were taken to military installations, jails, and improvised concentration camps. Thousands were packed into the National Football Stadium and held until they were removed to be tortured and killed. In the months that followed, 30,000 people were raped, subjected to inhuman torture, starved, abused, and murdered. And US Mike, socialist Mike Gonzalez, writes of this. He says, "They were the best and most courageous leaders of their class, systematically picked off with sophisticated foreign intelligence help. And they were not just killed, they were torn apart to warn and terrify the next generation. The rest were dealt with arbitrarily, to terrorise the population and give graphic notice that the new regime would give no quarter. That was the significance of the maimed bodies that floated every morning along Santiago's River Mapocho." The failure of the working class to launch a revolution had played exactly into the hands of the capitalists. A reliance on capturing the state and respect for Parliament led both to the disempowerment of the workers and the strengthening of the military, making it easier for Pinochet to rise. The tragic results of Chile's failed revolution teach us not that the working class went too far, but that it didn't go far enough. This question of the state, whether we're to smash it or to take hold of it, is therefore a crucial one. We have to be clear that no professional army has ever helped any working class in the struggle against exploitation. Why would it bring down the capitalist state that it so intimately belongs to? The dismantling of the military, police force and government by revolutionary means is a crucial part of avoiding the scenario where this machine is used for counter-revolution, as in the case of Chile. And this is also a point that helps us to understand why there are successful revolutions that end in dictatorships too. The state is an instrument of class rule, and where it's taken over rather than destroyed, that new political system can be no more than a powerful leader or party imposing its rule over the mass of people. And if you reflect back on the points that I made earlier about why revolutionary socialists think that we need to change not just those at the top of society, but the whole way things are run and how decisions are made, we can see how that process is incompatible with a consolidation of the capitalist state machine. To take the case of Cuba, the revolution that took place there in 1959 overthrew the right-wing dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista. But although popular, it was a guerrilla struggle which led the revolution and became the core of the new regime, not a mass workers' struggle. The role that workers and peasants were to play was largely that of the spectator. The guerrilla leaders sought not to empower the mass of people to create their own revolution, but to accept a new regime handed down to them from above. The movement didn't centre on the formation and power of workers' councils like the Cordones in Chile or the Soviets in Russia. And that explains why the social and economic structure of that society remained largely intact. By centering in an elitist way on a small, middle-class group that considered that it knew what was best for the country, it laid the basis for the undemocratic and oppressive nature of the government that continues there today. This is why socialist politics are about the mass of working people creating a revolution, what Marx called the self-emancipation of the working class. The working class has, within its cooperative and collective nature, the seeds for a radically different democratic society. The Soviets proved, as the Cordones may have, that workers can create a new system from below. In contrast, nationalist or middle-class-led revolutions look to the authority of the pre-existing government structure. And although they may have a genuine desire to rid society of a dictatorship, as in the case of Cuba, or a foreign occupation, these forces are not anti-capitalist in the sense that they stand to benefit from the continuation of capitalism, albeit in a different form. For revolutionary socialists, these lessons are instructive. Our politics must be based around real workers' power and direct democracy, not an armed struggle to capture the state. We need to use the power that we have at the point of production, in our workplaces, universities and community groups, to organise against the ruling class and to create a socialist society. And this is the kind of revolution we're fighting for, and it's a political aim that must remain clear and uncompromised. So to draw this together, yes, revolutions can lead to dictatorships. Where the only collective class, the working class, doesn't lead that revolution and the aim is to take hold of the state, then indeed this is likely to be the outcome. However, working class revolutions don't lead to dictatorships and in fact they have a tendency to be extremely democratic. Workers' councils, whether they be called cordones, Soviets or shoras, are the most direct and accountable form of decision-making bodies, and based at the heart of production in society, they form the basis for a social organisation that can do away with the exploitation and oppression of capitalism. A revolution led by these organs of workers' power that seeks not to compromise with capitalism but to defeat it is the only way we can achieve real liberation and democracy. Central to this project has to be a recognition that moderation doesn't avoid the wrath of the capitalist class. Their system is a brutal one and they'll go to the greatest of lengths to defend it. Dictatorship is used to crush the spirit of organised class-conscious workers, to impose the rule of a small few over the majority. Workers' struggle and revolution, which seeks to empower that majority, doesn't lead to dictatorship. But its defeat does, and that's why when we fight, we have to fight to win.